Welcome to this week's episode of Security Nation, the podcast where we talk to people who are doing interesting things to advance security. I'm your host, Jen Ellis. I'm Rapid7's VP of Community and Public Affairs. And with me is my amazing co-host, Todd Beardsley. How are you doing, Todd?
Ahoy, ahoy. I'm doing fantastic. And I'm very excited about today's guest.
Oh my God, I can barely contain my excitement.
I know, your security fangirl is showing.
It really is. And is it more awkward when it's someone you're friends with? It is. God, what if he comes on now and denies we're friends? Oh my God, the drama. Without further ado, Mr. H.D. Moore, woo!
Hey, folks.
I think that pretty much everybody who works in security knows who HD is, but in case you don't, and I'm overstating, HD has done a lot of cool things that make him quite known in security, including inventing Metasploit, which is a thing that we kind of have an interest in. But right now, these days, he is the VP of R&D at Atreides Partners, and he's also the CEO and founder of Critical Research, out of which he has launched a new project, which he's going to be speaking about today, which is very exciting. We asked HD to come on because... One, we love him, and any chance to get the band back together is very exciting. But two, October was the 10-year anniversary of Rapid7's acquisition of the Metasploit project, a project that HD started more than 10 years ago. And we thought this was a really great opportunity to sort of acknowledge it. So thank you to HD for everything he has done and continues to do. And then talk about the new stuff that HD is working on, like, you know, what great new things he's moved on to. Thanks for joining us, HD.
Oh, thanks for having me, y'all.
And I'm sorry for being overexcited and awkward. I just don't get to see you very often. It makes me very sad.
Me neither, and we live in the same city.
I mean, how is that even a thing? Like, surely you go to AHAs together.
I swear I see more Austin people outside of Austin than actually in Austin these days. It's kind of the curse of working from home is that you don't really leave for lunch breaks or really anything.
Yep.
And when you say working from home, like, let's be clear, we're talking about like a pretty tricked out compound. So like, it's not like people are just like, you know, dropping by to like say hi because
there are multiple layers to get through.
Right, right. You have to, yeah. And then you get into the underground bunker and like, I still haven't got that far yet. So it is pretty badass actually. I like it. It does look like you could survive many sorts of different types of attack. Like when the purge becomes a real thing, mm-hmm. You'll be safe in your bunker.
I'm excited about the new underwater level.
Me too. Yeah. Particularly in Austin in the summer.
There was actually literally an underground bunker that we found when going through construction documents. It was buried during the last round of construction on this plot, but technically it's still down there. There's still a storm shelter.
Of course there is. Rad. Of course there is. It makes perfect sense. So talking of things that you've built, see what I did there? Let's talk about Metasploit.
Sure.
It is 10 years on since Rapid7 somehow acquired this crazy open source project, Metasploit. HD, are you pleased with how things gone? I mean, I know I am. Since you're on this podcast, I expect you are. any comments or even positive or negative? You know, I think we live in open source land, so I think this is it's fairly normal to have some comments, some praise, and some criticism. So anything come to mind for you?
Yeah, I mean, early on, I mean, if you go back to 2003 when we started the Metasploit project, like 16 years ago, I guess now, it wasn't that popular. There are a lot of folks using it, but it wasn't, you know, considered a tool that people actually wanted to use. It wasn't considered safe to use. It wasn't considered something that, you know, you should legally be able to use in a lot of cases. So we kind of, we definitely got value out of the controversy. But if you look at kind of the time that Rapid7 acquired the project, we only had about 33,000 users based on our subversion stats at that point. Fast forward about a year or two post Rapid7, I think we're up to like 200 to 300,000 monthly users who were downloading the project. So even though, it was being managed by a corporation and being kind of run a little more professionally, it actually increased the user base substantially by at least 10x over those first 2 years. And these days, who knows what it is? I mean, maybe you guys have stats on it. So I've been very happy. I've been happy that when the project is still alive, it's amazing that so many people have been involved with it, that people are still contributing to it, that it's still serving as this kind of living archive of research techniques that have been discovered for the last 20-something years that are being turned into code that's actually being maintained. So, you know, managing a Ruby project, I'm sure, is not the most fun thing in the world, given how often dependencies change. But at the same time, you guys have been doing a great job of keeping the project up and running and making sure it's viable and you know, still relevant to today. So if you look at the types of things that have gone into Metasploit over the years, it started off being very focused on, you know, stack smashing and buffer overflows and heap overflows and all that fun stuff. Those became a little bit less relevant after all the mitigations went into place on the various operating systems. But things like logic bugs, protocol information leaks, things like web application vulnerabilities, those things don't really go away. And if anything, they've gotten worse. So it's been really cool seeing Metasploit take on things like, you know, ICS, everything from like car protocols via the adapter, things like that. Just a huge gamut of stuff that Metasploit does now that we never thought was even relevant to the project back in 2003.
And I will just jump out as the cheese monster on this podcast and in life generally, and just say a very quick, like, huge, huge thank you to all of the people who contribute to Metasploit. There is a super active community, as you said, and Metasploit is what it is in very large part thanks to that community. So thank you to all of you. We really super appreciate what you do.
Yeah, for sure. Like, I mean, as far as I can see, like, Metasploit is one of the very few corporate sponsored, truly open source projects. We don't just, you know, code with the windows open. We rely heavily on contributors like you. And, you know, I think that's really unusual. I mean, I started at Rapid7 shortly after that acquisition. It was shortly after because I wasn't super sure what this Rapid7 company was about.
Still not really.
still on the fence. We'll see. But they haven't screwed up Metasploit yet. So that's kind of why I'm still around.
Duly noted.
Uh-huh.
There's definitely not a lot of glory in working at Metasploit. Most of what we did was basically kind of code janitor work, cleaning things up, making sure things work properly, making sure dependencies work correctly even after other things upgrade. So I feel like the core of Metasploit always has been the community, and the project, the kind of the responsibility of the maintainers is just to make sure we can keep taking in new research and keep building out what the community provides. And I feel like Rapid7's been doing a great job of that.
Great. Well, that's wonderful to hear.
It is wonderful to hear. I'm all misty-eyed over here.
You guys are great janitors.
Yeah, I know. That's the nicest thing anyone said to me for a while. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So enough of this misty-eyed bullshit. Let's talk about what you're doing now.
Yeah.
Sure. So like probably as far as I've ever been doing computers, and even prior to computers, phone lines and stuff, I've always been really excited about kind of exploring networks and finding out what's out there and seeing all the just the weird menagerie of equipment that is connected to phones and networks and wireless and RF and all kinds of fun stuff. The work on Metasploit was great in that we got to like touch lots of different protocols, look at lots of different devices, look into tons of research. Shortly after, I guess while I was still working on Metasploit, I started doing a lot of internet-wide scanning research. And that meant looking at pretty much the whole internet and trying to figure out what protocols they're running, what services were exposed, using some of that to do vulnerability research and find vulnerabilities. But I've never really kind of got tired of it. I still enjoy that process of like exploring and finding out what's out there and doing you know, everything from fingerprinting to protocol recognition. And that's kind of led to my current project. About a year and a half ago, I started a project called Rumble Network Discovery. What we're trying to do is make a very easy, very effective way to identify what's on your network. So basically a glorified ping scanner, but like incredibly more accurate and faster and more useful than anything else out there today. What we notice is that as corporate networks become more and more hardened, as people go towards beyond corp, they've got fancy SDN stuff in place now, they've got hybrid cloud deployments, they're treating the internal networks like a lot of folks used to treat their external. So most desktops have firewalls enabled. They're scattered with all kinds of random IoT and consumer hardware devices now. As companies install everything from smart TVs to, you know, internet connected coffee machines and whatnot. So we're seeing a lot of really interesting equipment show up on corporate networks. We're also seeing corporate networks becoming more hardened than ever before. And as a result, standard discovery tools just don't work anymore. If you're using something like, you know, a standard port scanner or, you know, even your standard IT discovery tools or topology tools, oftentimes they can't provide you good information anymore because, hey, I can't talk to WMI in this Windows host. I can't enumerate everything through the Active Directory because all of our desktops have a firewall enabled. So how do you actually do accurate discovery when all the security mitigations are already in place? And that's kind of what we're trying to do with Rumble. We're trying to take the same approach that company like Rapid7 would take for vulnerability management, where it's very research heavy. We're trying to find different ways to leak information about a device to tell you whether or not it's been patched. We're doing the same level of effort just to identify what a device is.
Is this a paid service or solution, or is it free? Tell us everything.
Sure thing. It's a commercial project. So we had a beta that ran for about 6 months or so that was open. We still have things like free trials, so you can sign up and play that for sure. But the core public output from this thing is contributing back to open source fingerprint repositories. So even though the core of the product is commercial and we're doing everything we can to actually build a sustainable business out of it, hire people, all that fun stuff, we're also contributing back all the new fingerprints that we developed directly back to the Recog project, which is also managed by Rapid7. And for folks who don't have background with Recog is, if you go back a few years, we took the Nexpose fingerprint database within the commercial Nexpose product, made it open source, and then we modified Metasploit and Metasploit Pro to also use the same database. And going forward, we've had not just Rapid7 maintaining this thing, but lots of other companies who are contributing fingerprints back into it. So it's becoming kind of a cross-company open source fingerprint database that are used by multiple products and including Rumble. So as we build out new Rumble fingerprints for things like TLS fingerprints, TLS subject and issuer regexes, all the MDNS work we put in recently, all that's going right back into the open source Recog project, which then in turn powers things like Nexpose, but also Metasploit, Metasploit Pro, and other projects that are based on it.
Awesome. I do love a free ad, and I would highly encourage people who are interested in fingerprinting to take a look at Recog and ideally, like, you know, contribute. If you have fingerprints, we want them. Yeah, get involved.
Yeah, we talk about open source a lot at Rapid7, and I often say, like, Recog is I would say the second most popular open source project that we have. If you lump all the Metasploit projects into one, so like not counting Meterpreter, not counting Metasploit payloads, but you know, if you discount other things, everything connected directly with Metasploit, that is Metasploit only, then Recog is definitely our second most popular. Like right now, I'm just looking at the stats right now. We had a commit 6 days ago on that. Like it is under active development. We have a bunch of releases. It's got like 250 stars or something like that. Compared to Metasploit, it's like 18,000 stars. So it is a distant second.
That's right. not really in the same sort of planetary system. But yeah.
But hey, that it depends on you. And if you like Metasploit stuff and you, for some reason, like to write things in XML, Recog is your project. It's great for protocol nerds.
It's funny, like I was all sort of giddy with excitement at the start of this episode, but really this is like your ultimate episode. We're talking about open source. How excited are you, Todd?
I'm delighted.
So HD, I remember when we first chatted about Rumble. One of the questions I asked you was like, how does it relate to Enmap? Because I had heard some people sort of comparing the two and it seemed like maybe there was a little bit of confusion around that. So maybe you could help clarify that.
Oh, sure thing. I mean, Enmap's great. I've been using it for, I think, what, 20 years now. It's kind of a gold standard for port scanning. The things that you want to do with Enmap are typically, you know, port scan the network, identify services. And what Enmap is really good at is telling you what a very particular service is running, but also what exact OS a device is running. What it's not so great at is telling you what the device physically is. So Enmap can be a great tool for telling you exactly what Linux kernel version is running on which device or which web server is running on which port. But if you're trying to figure out, is that thing a Roku? Is that a smart TV? Is that a printer? That's not really what Enmap's about. So it's kind of a different level of discovery. Enmap is a great Swiss Army knife for all kinds of other stuff. But what we're trying to focus on Rumble is how do we very quickly identify what a device is, what its purpose is, and other information about it, such as like its MAC addresses, its extra IP addresses, things like that, very quickly with the least amount of traffic we can send. But we don't necessarily care about all the security stuff. We're not looking for vulnerabilities. We're not looking for the exact kernel version. That stuff isn't necessarily relevant to our use case. So it's a little bit different use case in that sense, where Enmap is a great kind of general purpose tool, and it's used by, you know, tons of people, of course, but also by tons of products. There's a lot of discovery products out there that embed the Enmap engine in it, and they all call it slightly differently. Metasploit Pro uses Enmap internally as well for discovery. So it's not a terrible tool. It's great for discovery work, but it often requires a lot of tuning to get the exact results you want when you're doing product integration. So we started the Rumble project with kind of a different set of goals, and we had, you know, as a result, we got to make different trade-offs. The way that Enmap does things like retry handling and SYN retries is different from how we do it in Rumble. The default probes that are sent by Rumble are quite a bit different from the default probes by Enmap. We focus a lot more on manufacturer discovery protocols, on extracting information from squirrely kind of oddball fields. Rumble can identify the MAC address of a device multiple hops away through 15 different protocols. We'll leak it out, of course, through things like NetBIOS, but we'll also use things like SNMP fields. SNMP version 3, even when you're unauthenticated to it, often leaks the MAC address back and the engine ID, but each vendor encodes it slightly differently with different byte sequences and different padding. So we just did a ton of research trying to figure out how to actually extract, for us, the most useful fields about these devices, which are IP addresses, MAC addresses, and you know, device identifying information through all sorts of fun protocols. And so a lot of that work goes back into the Recog project. A lot of it doesn't, because it's part of our kind of core Rumble IP. But that's kind of our goal, and that's kind of the difference, is that Recog is very much focused on device identification discovery, and Enmap really is a Swiss Army knife.
So, I mean, it sounds like they're fairly complementary then.
Oh, definitely. I mean, we kind of expect most people who have an interest in tools like Rumble probably have already used Enmap and vice versa. There's definitely a lot of overlap there. It's more of a question of, if you're just trying to do a quick identification of everything on your network and you want to know what the thing actually is, that's where our focus on the Rumble side may pay off better than using, you know, either Enmap or another open source tool in the command line. not to say you can't get similar results, but it often takes a lot more work.
So I have a question, and maybe this is a dumb question. Can Rumble tell me, like, if I have a device that has several IP addresses on the same network, can Rumble tell me, like, oh, that's all just one machine, and it's one of these?
Yep, absolutely. That's one of the things we spend the most time on. If you look at the two things that really set Rumble apart these days, I'll make it three. You've got remote MAC address discovery, which goes a long way towards uniquely identifying a device and also identifying multi-home devices. Because if you can find out that 15 devices on the same network have the same MAC address, you can almost guarantee they're the same physical, you know, device. So using things like the MAC address, you can uniquely identify devices that way. I mean, the nice thing about having a SaaS product is we can figure those things out pretty quick and blacklist them. So we have a pretty good idea of which MAC addresses are bunk, which ones are not unique in those cases. Mm-hmm. Same thing on the IP side. We'll find ways we can leak the list of interfaces of a device remotely without credentials. So we use things like NetBIOS to get the list of remote IP addresses on a Windows device, unauthenticated across the network, across multiple hops. We'll then use the fact that we can see all those multiple IPv4 addresses on it. We can then link those devices together in the display and say, these are actually all the same physical device. And kind of the last piece where this all really comes together is now that you've got a way to uniquely correlate devices across multiple hops away, you can then track them as their IP addresses move. So we spend a whole lot of time doing things like accurate DHCP tracking. And the thing is, like, inventory, like network discovery and asset inventory is something that most people in the security space are using security products to accomplish this today. You know, a lot of people I talk to are using things like Metasploit, using Nmap, using Nessus, using Nexpose, using all these products that are not really designed for inventory, but that's the best thing they have available because it works the hardest to identify devices. So looking at that problem set of like, hey, everyone who's using security products today is using them for inventory, but these products weren't really designed to be doing inventory. So Rumble's an attempt to build an inventory first project and really focus on just doing discovery, and that's it.
So what next? Where are you headed next with this thing?
I hope I work on this the rest of my life. It's a lot of fun.
but okay, so you said that you did a beta recently and that closed, and now you're building customers, and it sounds like there's a few different people working on it. Is that right?
Right now it's just me. We had about 3,000 users in the beta, tracking about 3 million assets. After we've gone through the first, I guess, month and two-thirds of sales, we're up to about 75 paid customers. We've got a pretty good roadmap ahead, and we're hoping to start hiring people starting next year.
Holy cow, HD. That's really cool. Congratulations.
Oh, thanks. I mean, our customers have been amazing. Like, our users were great on the beta side. You know, the product wouldn't be what it was today without all the feedback we got from users and all the, you know, them calling out our boneheaded mistakes in UX, things like that. So we're still definitely not the product we want to build. Is definitely not done yet, but we feel like we've gotten a lot closer because of the great feedback from the beta community.
That is, that's awesome. So what you're saying is, and I appreciate that you're breaking it to me gently, but you're saying you're probably not going to come back to Rapid7.
Probably not. Wish you guys the best.
Ooh, okay, it's fine. I will, I'll clear up the little shrine that I built to you. It's fine. all right. Well, thank you very much for coming and telling us all about this. And again, like, you know, thank you for everything that you've done in the open source world, for the projects that you have, you know, invested a lot of your time and your effort into, and a lot of which has benefited Rapid7, but also has benefited the broader security community a huge amount. We all appreciate that. Thank you for continuing to contribute to Recog and to Metasploit. I think it's a great and important thing for the community that you're still involved in those things and people know that you care about them, which is lovely, even though you are the busiest man on earth and starting a company, and also at the same time have a job at Atreides. It's amazing. So yeah, thank you for what you're working on, and Todd will see you at the next AHA, it sounds like.
Oh, sounds good. Thanks for having me on.
Okay, Todd. So I guess it's time for the rapid rundown.
Yeah, so the rapid rundown this week. Well, it is a holiday time here. We're recording this just a couple days before you're hearing it. So I'm right out of Thanksgiving, which the easy thing to talk about would be like Cyber Monday stuff, but we're not going to talk about that today. What I do want to talk about is how to give your family the gift of security for Christmas.
All I want for Christmas is a little bit more security.
Right. You know, I think most of the people who are likely likely to be listening to this podcast probably finds themselves drafted as IT, you know, tech support for their family over the holiday. Either they are swinging by or there is some kind of get together. We just got through a get together. And I would just want to underline that rather than telling your family to just not get fished, which is not terribly actionable advice, here's something you can actually do. If you happen to be near some family that probably don't care too much or know too much about cybersecurity stuff at home, offer to take a look at their router, their home router. It is quite likely it hasn't gotten an update in a long, long time, and it just would behoove you to maybe go through, look for a refresh. I'd say most modern routers today have some kind of check for updates. Some of them even, I know Belkin in particular, are doing updates kind of in the background without any user interaction, which is great, but a lot don't. So this is also the kind of thing that tends to last a really long time in people's houses. They don't have really any moving parts. They can conceivably live 10 years or so without ever getting an update. And this is a fine thing to do. This is a service. You can also offer a good, and that is buy them a new router for Christmas. And not only that, you can configure it ahead of time. So like, what I would suggest doing is buy your family, you know, a family member, you know, parents or kids or aunts and uncles, cousins, whoever, buy them a router, just something modern and fairly recent. They tend to run, you know, under $100. You want to go like over $30, probably in that narrow range. It will be reasonably modern. It probably has this automatic updates, and you can configure it yourself and then just ship it to them with instructions. I think this, you know, because like you can open the box,
wow,
set up a username and password, do all the things you're supposed to do. You could set up an IoT password. This is what I use my guest network functionality for on my router. Mine is called IoT Dumpster Fire. And that's where I stash all my IoT stuff. And people who come over for Thanksgiving and they want to get on my wireless, I'm like, oh yeah, just join IoT Dumpster Fire. I don't care. And so that way, those devices end up not talking to other machines on your network, like your work laptop or your regular phones or anything like that. So it's a pretty great way to keep things segregated. Network segregation comes up over and over again on every pen test finding. And so do a little proactive anti-pen testing in your own house and in the homes of your loved ones.
I'm so sad that I have not been invited to Christmas at the Beardsley household now. And boy, do I hope that I get you for Secret Santa one day, because you are clearly the king of imaginative gift giving.
I think it's great. I think it's a fine thing to do. And you can rewrap the router, and you can have like little, how cool is it, right? Like you could have like a nice calligraphy instructions on how to plug it in and how to throw out the old one. By the way, when they throw out the old ones, you're going to want to probably, well, you always want to recycle things, but do a factory reset before you get rid of these things, because that way all the old data goes away. So things like old passwords and
stuff. I'm super interested in this topic. Mm-hmm. The old tech thing, like do a factory reset, wipes the data. Like how effective really is that? Like can people come and mm-hmm. take that tech and like figure out a way of getting the data back? I say sounding paranoid.
It's better than nothing.
Oh, that's reassuring.
It's better than not wiping it at all. But when it comes down to the like forensic value of hitting factory reset, that's kind of up in the air still. Yeah. Depends on the device. Like it's down to every manufacturer. It's like when you erase a hard drive for people who used to erase hard drives a long time ago. Now we don't. But you would like, there's an erase and then there's a secure erase that like overwrites everything with zeros or like random zeros and ones, right? For IoT stuff, typically the kinds of things you'll find on like IoT junk that you end up recycling are just like Wi-Fi SSIDs and passwords. You know, if you change it every couple of years, which is not a bad idea anyway, like that doesn't really super matter unless you're the sort that is reusing passwords all over the place, in which case stop doing that. And beyond that, like there are IoT devices that want to talk to, you know, your Amazon account or your Google account or something like that. And they may be storing passwords or tokens or something like that. So like when it comes down to it, like I can't say that factory reset always works all the time. I can't even give a guess on how often it doesn't work. We have looked at this in a lab setting a couple times, and generally speaking, factory reset is good enough. You know, I don't think we have like an army of cyber thieves hanging out outside of Goodwill waiting for people to drop off their IoT gear. Right? not yet, anyway. So like your risk is pretty low, right? Like it's there is no, you know, criminal enterprise looking for this thrift store tech. But if you're tossing older things, especially things that did store passwords instead of like tokens or something like that, I don't know, erase them carefully, whatever that means.
So that would be my question. So like if you are a little more paranoid about this, or for some reason you have a different risk profile, I mean, are you talking about like a giant magnet? Are you talking about putting it in your microwave? What is the best thing you can do here? I'm assuming not putting it in your microwave.
So we want to generally recycle electronics because they have like heavy metals and stuff. You don't want that in landfills and junk, or going into the ocean. But that said, like taking a drill to it, magnets are not like, unless you have access to crazy powerful, like large rare earth magnets, that's not going to do much for you. You know, it turns out things are pretty hardened against that today. But physical drills are pretty great. A reciprocating saw with a metal blade, blade four metal, that works out pretty well. Also, a wonderful holiday gift, because who doesn't love a reciprocating saw?
Again, I am very sad that I'm not getting a Christmas gift from you, but now I know what to get you.
Oh, no, I already have one. Thank you. I just got one. This last week, and it was great.
Did you get that in sales? Because if so, we should talk about tips for shopping online.
I'm not talking about tips for shopping online. So like physically destroying so most IoT devices don't like have like a hard drive or anything like that, but they do have, they have like flash memory. So locating that, especially if it comes with like an SD card, you can pop that SD card out, and then you're pretty good on data. Like pop out the SD card, put it in a drawer, and then get rid of the rest of the thing. It is unlikely you're going to have a lot of data like left on the device.
Okay. And when you say, you know, we want to be recycling electronics, do you mean recycling, or do you mean sort of, as you said earlier, Goodwill, that kind of thing?
You're going to want to drop them off either at like a purpose-built recycling center. So something like Best Buy tends to run these things. They'll have like a bin, and then they'll just go recycle it and pull the metals out. Goodwill, if you're worried about the data on the device, I wouldn't go like the thrift store route. The fire department actually is a pretty good source. You can call them and say, hey, what do I do with my old electronics? And they will tell you. They often run their own bins, because you're not supposed to, you're not supposed to throw out old batteries and stuff. You're supposed to, like, when I was growing up, you gave them to the fire department and then they would get rid of them. And that's still true today. Like you can still give them a call and they'll tell you what to do with them.
Will they give you a ride in the truck?
If you are under six, then probably.
Okay. All right. Okay. So that's just a note of caution to people, just so we manage expectations. We don't want anyone turning up thinking that they're going to get some sort of wonderful day out. All right. Thanks very much, Todd. I now have to try and figure out something to get you for Christmas that isn't a drill or a router, apparently. Okay. Wonderful. So I think that, that concludes this this episode of Rapid Rundown. A last little thing. There's some interesting things that happened. Apparently, policymakers do not like to drop everything for Thanksgiving. So there are a couple of interesting things that happened at the end of last week and beginning of this. So both OMB, the Office of Management and Budget, and DHS CISA have come out with requests for comment on proposals around vulnerability disclosure processes for federal government agencies. So I highly recommend the people who are interested in this topic, and you know, Rapid7 is a huge supporter of coordinated vulnerability disclosure and organizations having a way for people to report and for them to triage. So I highly recommend anyone else who is interested in this to go and check those things out. I think if you Google OMB VDP or DHS VDP, you should be able to find them. And then this week, a couple of different senators came out with two different proposals for privacy bills. So what we might do is, depending on what else is happening in the world, next episode, we might invite our very good friend, Holly Geiger, who runs Rapid7's public policy program, to come join Todd and I, and he can talk through some of this stuff for us.
I love talking to Harley.
As do I.
And you will love hearing him.
All right. So, Todd, thank you very much. Thank you, as usual, for educating me and putting up with my stupid questions. Bree, Thank you for everything you do, including not hitting me over the head all the time. I deserve it. And thank you again for our special guest, H.G. Moore, who we love and adore. Oh my God, I ended with a poem.
Hey, it's a holiday rhyming miracle.
It is. Thanks.